Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher.
A dozen or so years ago, I found myself in China as part of a delegation of American scholars and policymakers. Sitting in my hotel in Beijing, I decided to conduct a thought experiment. Firing up Google, I put in a few search terms that I knew were sensitive to the powers that be, words like democracy, freedom, and Tiananmen Square. The results were predictable and very depressing. I repeatedly hit a webpage that told me there was an error and that the information was unavailable. This was my first experience with China's Great Firewall, the extensive censorship, monitoring, and information control that makes up the core of the Chinese government's social control system. But the Great Firewall is only part of the story, because increasingly, the PRC has not been content simply to censor the information available to its own citizens. It's also made shaping global perceptions about China, its foreign policy, and its place in the world a major part of its foreign outreach. The scope of that effort is enormous. Back in 2017, David Shambaugh of George Washington University estimated that China was spending approximately $10 billion a year on its assorted soft power programs. And those efforts have only ramped up against the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic and growing Chinese activism around the world. Last year, Freedom House estimated that Beijing was, quote, devoting billions of dollars a year to its foreign propaganda and censorship efforts. So what does this propaganda push look like? And how is China's messaging changing the contours of global discourse? To get some answers, I turn to Joshua Kurlansik. Josh is currently a senior fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the author of the just published Beijing's Global Media Offensive, China's Uneven Campaign to Influence Asia and the World. He was previously a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and before that was a fellow at the USC Center on Public Diplomacy and the Pacific Council on International Policy. Josh, wonderful to chat with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
A logical place for us to start is the central premise of your book, because in it, you sketch a massive and ambitious effort on the part of the Chinese government to shape global perceptions and to alter and manipulate how people think about the PRC and its objectives. So give us the highlights here. What's China trying to achieve and what's it saying in order to do that?
Sure. Although I also want to mention that the subtitle of the book is that they are not always doing everything so well. The subtitle of the book emphasizes that they're actually failing in a lot of ways. But the book goes through several different ways in which China has in the last 10 years boosted its efforts to intervene in other countries' politics and societies, which is not something it really had done since the Mao era, except in its near neighborhood in Southeast Asia and Taiwan and a little bit in South Asia. This has now been expanded massively to cover almost the whole globe, which is not something China was doing in a very significant way 10 or 15 years ago, intervening in the politics and the societies in the United States or Australia or Germany or whatever. So I lay out several different ways of doing it. One, dramatically expanding their state media outlets. The three main ones are called China Global Television Network, China Radio International, and Xinhua. And trying to make them credible voices that could boost what China calls its discourse power, its ability to shape conversations in the world about China and about all range of issues. They're intensely aggrieved by the idea that most world issues, including those related to China, the news coverage and what shapes the people's ideas about it is mostly or almost exclusively shaped by news outlets based in prominent developed liberal democracies. So that could be the New York Times, Fox News, the BBC, the Nikkei, Le Monde, whatever, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And they want those state media to be able to bolster China's discourse power. A second thing they're doing is taking over Chinese language outlets all over the world, which they've been enormously successful in, including in the United States. A third aspect that I talk about in the book is China's ramped up use of disinformation on a whole wide range of social media platforms. Although I still think that China is pretty clumsy in their disinformation as compared to Russia. They don't do a very good job of playing on organic divides within other country societies, which is something that Russia does very, very well. Fourth, I talk about their ability to use a kind of sharp power, coercive, corrosive, covert power to gain greater control over student associations, diaspora associations, research institutes, think tanks, universities, both in developing countries and in developed countries. I need to stop right here for 1 second and say that the Council on Foreign Relations, where I work, takes no money from any government, no money from any foreign government, no money from the US government. And then finally, I talk in the book about old-fashioned influence, which is, I kind of define it as things that existed before the internet, paying politicians, espionage, using ways to covertly insert your own operatives into the political campaigns of other countries. This has been a problem in Australia, New Zealand. Canada is now reeling from a massive scandal in which there are allegations that in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections, China not only spread around money, but actually inserted operatives, some of whom were actually made it to be the chief of staff of some of the campaigns. There was a modest degree of Chinese meddling in the 2022 US midterms, very modest. And I think the next stage of that, there's an explosive report in the Associated Press that just came out in the last 2 days about Chinese massive, massive influence peddling in Utah, seemingly actually with the acceptance of a lot of Utah politicians. I encourage everyone to read the AP report. It's pretty damning. But the next step is for China to go beyond trying to influence Congress people or MPs who are increasingly going to have their guard up to influence state and local or provincial and officials where their safeguards are much, much lower. And we already saw that in the Bay Area with this case with this Chinese operative named Fang Fang, where there was links to Congressman Eric Swalwell's office, but she also was circulating among a bunch of Bay Area lawmakers, some of whom were lower than the congressional level and probably didn't have the same amount of scrutiny or preparation to deal with someone like her.
I think that's a great overview. And in particular, the way China's soft power sort of morphs very nicely into Chinese sharp power and how one plays off the other. But I want to go back to something you mentioned at the outset, because you mentioned the subtitle of your book. And you call in the subtitle and in the book itself, you call China's global media efforts uneven. I want to drill down a little bit. What do you mean by that? In what ways is China failing or is it losing ground in the media space?
In the media space, I would say what they've had success in is for sure taking control of virtually every Chinese language media outlet around the world. There is almost no independent Chinese language media anywhere. And that has been done by having Chinese companies buy into them or simply by having pro-Beijing tycoons or other business people buy up outlets in places from like Canada or the US or Malaysia or Australia and then change the coverage from some degree of independent reportage to simply pro-Beijing. There are exceptions. There's still quality independent coverage in Taiwan and some other places, but they've been very successful in that. But with their big three state media, with China Global Television Network, which they spent huge amounts of money on and for years hired quality local reporters from many countries around the world, including in the US. They hired excellent local reporters in Africa. They even hired people in Africa who had made their names at local papers investigating Chinese corruption. They hired them. They hired good reporters in Southeast Asia, et cetera. But China Global Television Network has not reached really much of an audience. And that's because even though I think they wanted it to be like Al Jazeera, a situation in which you have a channel that's based in an authoritarian monarchy, and that channel does not cover that authoritarian monarchy and does not cover the problems that the authoritarian monarchy has or probably fairly cover some of its relations with its neighbors, including Israel. In other parts of the world, Al Jazeera does produce quality reporting. But China couldn't do that with CGTN because with Qatar, there's only a limited range of issues that people care about Qatar. So once you get away from those, the Al Jazeera journalists, for example, in Southeast Asia or Latin America or whatever, were given wide range to produce quality reporting. Virtually every issue in the world can have some link to China. So the idea that China could create a network that was doing independent reporting while also censoring its reporting on China just didn't work. And so as China also has become more authoritarian, CGTN has become much more turgid, propagandistic. So it has failed to gain an audience. Same thing for China Radio International. Xinhua, however, I think has been successful at China's aims of influencing global discourse. Xinhua, unlike a TV channel or a radio station, is encountered passively. You have to turn the television on and seek out China Global Television Network. But Xinhua has signed content sharing agreements with a whole wide range of news outlets around the world, mostly in developing countries, but including in some wealthy countries like Italy and Germany. So Xinhua increasingly gets translated into local languages in quality news publications in places like Thailand or Malaysia or other places. And people in those countries are reading Xinhua copy. So for example, in Thailand, the best outlets in Thailand, the equivalent of like the New York Times or whatever, have signed content sharing agreements with Xinhua, which is cheaper than the other global news wires or sometimes offered free. And they are increasingly relying on Xinhua copy for a lot of stories. Now, people pick that up, it's in Thai, and maybe at the end of the story, it says Xinhua, or maybe it doesn't even say that. It might just say agencies, like news agencies, or it might say nothing at all. And to be frank, most people who read newspapers or online news sources don't really pay much attention to who writes them. I was a journalist. As a journalist, we like to think that, but unless it's some famous columnist, really most people don't pay any attention. So they read the whole article in this prestigious Thai news outlet translated from Xinhua. Do they look at the bottom and even see that it came from Xinhua? I doubt it. So Xinhua is expanding, and I think you're going to see more and more in that. That's been a huge success for the Chinese government.
With regard to the sort of the broader strategy that's animating this, you talk in your book about how under Xi Jinping, the idea of a global struggle has become this major motif of Chinese foreign policy. What role does disinformation play in the Chinese Communist Party's struggle against America and the West?
Yeah, I mean, Xi Jinping has been the first Chinese leader since Mao to openly enunciate several concepts. One, that China is engaged in a kind of not just regional, but global struggle with, I don't like to use the term the West, because China is engaged in a struggle with liberal democracy. And there, some of the places that are it's most engaged in with the struggle are right by China in Asia, like South Korea and Japan. So let's just say a struggle with liberal democracy. He's also been the first Chinese leader to openly say that China has a model of authoritarian capitalism and managerial governance that he has on several occasions said is superior to the liberal democracy. Now, I think that boast has been severely undermined in the last 3 years as China mismanaged both initial parts of COVID and then zero COVID. It's also been undermined by the fact that Xi Jinping has changed China from consensus authoritarianism, where experts really had an ability to wield influence, to one-man rule, which is always more dangerous. But he has been the first Chinese leader to openly say, like, we have a different model and that model is better. So those two things. And third, you know, increasingly, especially in more openly aligning with Putin, despite the fact that I still believe that China thinks Putin's invasion of Ukraine is crazy. And the way that this media and disinformation and information campaign plays out based on Xi Jinping's much more aggressive, assertive in dealing with other diplomats and in public settings. And in addition, Xi Jinping has increasingly tried to use harsh economic coercion against countries that for whatever reason, alienate China. And that could be Australia for calling for an independent COVID investigation. It could be a place as small as Lithuania, where China applied enormous economic coercion simply because Lithuania allowed Taiwan to open an office there. And instead of calling it Taipei, they called it Taiwan's office. The way that the media and disinformation play in is China has increasingly learned from Russia. One thing that they have started to copy from Russia increasingly that you didn't see 4 or 5 years ago was using disinformation to directly attack democratic leaders for failed governance, and to be just to generally denigrate the idea of democracy as an effective system, period. So Russia has been doing this for a long time, but China was reluctant to do that until the last few years. But now you see more and more disinformation coming from China that plays up the supposed problems with democracy, plays up conflict in democracy, plays up the idea that democracies are gridlocked and can't get things done, plays up the idea that specific democratic leaders are corrupt, certainly has focused on a lot of the problems in the United States. So that's one way that the disinformation, I mean, it's not all disinformation. Democracy hasn't had its greatest last 15 years, but a lot of it is false, what they say. And then secondly, China has increasingly used disinformation to promote its model by doing what Russia has done for a long time, which is play up organic divides within other countries' societies and then use those to spread wild conspiracy theories. For example, Russia was very early to use its disinformation to piggyback on racial and social and class divides in the US in the last 4, 5, 6 years, as well as in Europe, and then use those to spread wild conspiracy theories and also to conceal them, the where it's coming from, very effectively. Unfortunately, most of the major social media platforms are now have laid off many of their content moderators, and some people think they shouldn't have content moderators, but you fire all your content moderators, you're opening the door to Russia and China doing whatever they want on the platform as well. So China has increasingly played up the organic divides in democratic societies and then added layers of conspiracy theories on top of them. Those are things clearly learned from Russia, and I expect them to learn from Russia even more as they get better at it.
No, I think that point about the authoritarian learning that you're seeing in the disinformation space between China piggybacking on Russian narratives, China sort of optimizing Russian narratives is, I think, hugely important. So we've been talking about China's messages generally, and that's obviously hugely important, but the vehicles that China uses to disseminate them are pretty significant too. In your book, you detail how China has essentially gained control of most Chinese language media in New Zealand, for example. Talk about those takeovers a little bit. How is Beijing orchestrating them, and what's the impact in terms of local views of China?
Beijing has gained control of nearly all the Chinese language media in New Zealand, Australia, and virtually everywhere else. And that includes places with very large percentages of the population are Chinese speaking and reading, like Malaysia and Singapore. But even in places like New Zealand and Australia, Canada, and the United States, there are large populations of people who get their news first in Chinese. And in some of those places, like Australia and the United States and Canada in particular, a lot of those Chinese populations, ethnic Chinese populations, happen just through happenstances to be located in congressional or parliamentary districts that are heavily contested. So, for example, in Australia, the Chinese population sits primarily in what we would call, you know, the most contested seats, the like battleground seats. So their votes don't matter more, but in a way they do. And the way that China has done that, like I said, is two ways. One, they actually have Chinese companies buy into some of these outlets. Two, they have either Chinese nationals or citizens of countries who are simply sympathetic to China, whether be for business reasons or other reasons, buy up those outlets and just quash all the independent reporting. And three of those few remaining independent publications that still exist, China puts an enormous amount of pressure on potential advertisers, people who would be advertising in Chinese, maybe local Chinese companies, and even non-Chinese companies that simply don't want to alienate China, not to advertise in those publications. And we've seen that in Australia and in other places. So they have a three-pronged strategy: buy the outlet with an actual Chinese company, have a local person buy the outlet and quash independent reporting, and then use advertising to pressure any remaining independent media. Like I said, there's still a few outlets left, but not many, and really none in the United States that are credible.
So I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is the COVID-19 pandemic. In the last episode of this podcast, I spoke with my colleague, Michael Soblik, who you know, about COVID and pandemic-related propaganda on the part of the PRC. And I think it's an interesting story because China's efforts to shape perceptions about the virus and its own role in spreading it are ramping up once again. And we clearly see this in Chinese messaging and responses to the US and Europe today. But I wonder, is this playing out in the developing world as well now?
Yeah, I think that they're definitely spreading this through the developing world. I mean, by the developing world is primarily Latin America and Africa. I mean, in Southeast Asia, you have some wealthier countries and also a much higher degree of savvy about China in general than you would have in Africa and Latin America, simply because they've been sitting next to China for their entire existence. You have a bunch of authoritarian countries in mainland Southeast Asia, including one that's at war with itself in Myanmar, where they don't have time to listen to anything. The country's just collapsed. But yes, it's spreading in developing countries as well, where there are still warmer feelings towards China. If you look at Pew polling, for example, in most developed democracies, China's public image now is horrible. And that includes developed democracies where China's public image was actually pretty good 5 or 6 years ago: Spain, the Netherlands, France, even Australia. China's public image 7, 8 years ago was relatively warm, and China was obviously huge contributor to the Australian economy and still is. So Australia is still stuck in some very problematic strategic/economic delicate dance. But yes, it's spreading in the developing world. However, that developing world where China is gaining ground no longer includes Eastern Europe or Central Europe, which are sort of borderline developed. China actually had really, really warm relations with most of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe. In fact, that was one of the places in the world where they had vested most heavily in both soft and sharp power, in media, in a whole wide range of things. But they flushed all of that down the toilet by supporting Putin and the Ukraine invasion. And so now their public image in virtually all of those Central and Eastern European countries is terrible.
Let's end with Taiwan, which is arguably the central pivot of Chinese foreign policy. And it's also a petri dish for CCP disinformation and the place where, as you've written, China's disinformation tactics have become the most sophisticated. So explain what you mean by that. What's China saying to the island and about the island? And how is this changing global perceptions? Or is it?
So two things. First of all, Taiwan is actually one of the places that has proven quite resilient to Chinese disinformation. And that's because Taiwan, like some countries in Southeast Asia, has a much longer history of dealing with it. So Taiwan still has some of the very independent Chinese language media that does quality reporting about the PRC. Taiwan also now has a massive influx of foreign reporters, because one thing we didn't mention is that in order to gain discourse power, China has not only ramped up its own media outlets, but basically thrown out virtually every foreign reporter from China. The New York Times is holding on to like one or two. I think the Journal, the Wall Street Journal, is like holding on to one or two, but when their visas come up, they might be thrown out too. But there's very, very few. So by throwing them all out, it's a black box now, right? So China gains greater control over the discourse power of what happens in China. It makes it much, much harder for anyone to get credible information. But to go back to Taiwan, Taiwan has been pretty good about, if we're just talking about disinformation towards Taiwan, about rebutting it, dealing with it. There are some media outlets in Taiwan that are definitely pro-PRC. Some have been alleged to be paid off or very close to the PRC. I'm choosing my words very carefully because one of these outlets has sued the Financial Times for slander and libel. But Taiwan in general has been fairly robust. And there's other reasons for that too. The Taiwanese government under the DPP has embarked on a very aggressive digital literacy campaign, which I wish we had in the United States. And one of the things I recommend in the book is that developed democracies need to get on the stick quickly and pour money into digital literacy campaigns starting from kindergarten. And Taiwan is not the only place where you could copy from. Finland has a very effective program. Italy has a very effective program. It would be valuable to learn not only how to avoid state-sponsored propaganda, but just how to learn what's credible on the internet and to avoid all sorts of other problems. Real money spent on digital literacy in every public school would be a valuable use of US money. And I'm sure it would be a drop in the budget compared to the money being spent on industrial policy or, you know, for fighter jets or whatever. So on Taiwan itself, Taiwan has done a very good job of protecting itself from Chinese disinformation. But Chinese disinformation about Taiwan still wears on the Taiwanese population. It's just wearing over and over and over, despite the fact that they've done a good job to keep hearing that, you know, if you have a war, you're going to lose, you're going to get killed, et cetera, et cetera. There's a wearing effect of that, of just being barraged by that all the time, despite the fact that Taiwan is quite good at sorting out fact from fiction. In terms of how China is portraying Taiwan and its role with Taiwan to the world and the disinformation, I don't think it's been that successful right now. I think what China wants with the disinformation about Taiwan is to keep other governments in Asia thinking, well, if it comes down to war, the stakes are too high for us to get involved. There's a lot of disinformation aimed at the Philippines, a lot aimed at Japan, a lot aimed at South Korea, a lot aimed at Thailand, where the US does have a critical base, although it's a little farther from Taiwan. And a lot aimed at Pacific Islands, including Guam, as well as quite a lot increasingly aimed at Americans filtered through both extreme left and extreme right platforms, talking about, you know, the level of casualties that would potentially happen, which isn't necessarily disinformation. You could have millions of people die. But I don't know about the US public. That's a little bit harder to assess because no one in the US public remembers such a thing, unless you're 95 years old, right? You don't remember a hot war between two major powers like this. So I'm not sure what the US public thinks. In terms of the countries in East Asia where China has been spreading this disinformation, and I think you see from the strategic decisions being made by the Philippines, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and to a lesser extent, India and Thailand, that they are not buying the idea that they necessarily should sit out and not play any role. The Philippines, whose president has absolutely no love for the US at all, he has dramatically ramped up the strategic ties with the US, as has been the case with India, as has obviously been the case with Australia. Japan is pushing for a much greater defense budget and has all but made clear that were there to be a conflict, Japan will get involved, which is a dramatically different step from where things were 10 or 15 years ago. So I don't think China has yet been that successful in scaring other countries in Asia into the idea that, like, you should just stay out of this. Whether they've been successful in scaring Americans is a different question, but I mean, American war planners probably have been successful at scaring Americans. If you look at some of the war scenarios put out by all sorts of credible institutions, they're scary. China doesn't need to add disinformation about that. So,
all right, let's stop there. Josh, thank you so much for sharing the insights and putting some meat on the bones of this particular topic.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.